If there's only one thing, I would look at war, famine, poverty, you know, issues of human suffering. Yeah. But because I'm a professor of election law and voting rights, I would tie it back to democracy. And so the one thing that I think can tie it all together and help on some of those major issues of human suffering is a better commitment to democracy and stronger voter engagement and stronger education, civics education.
Good.
And, you know, in the United States, you know, we have voter turnout in presidential elections of 60 or 65%. I think that's pretty horrible. And, you know, that needs to be a lot higher. It's not clear whether that would actually change outcomes in a place like America, which is already somewhat of a democracy, at least seen around the world as one of the most important democracies. But I do think that this collective action towards self-governance with better informed electorate can help to, you know, realize greater good for everyone.
Joshua Douglas is a law professor at the University of Kentucky. Besides running the marathon, playing baseball, hiking, and traveling, his most recent hobby is to play the guitar, which he even brought to Italy, where I met him for this episode. He promised me that the next time we record, he would play us a song, and I have a video to prove it, so this is definitely happening. He also has two kids who keep him busy and to whom he dedicates his latest book. It's entitled The Court versus the Voters, to be published on the 14th of May, 2024, and I give you the link in the description to pre-order it. In this episode, Joshua Douglas reveals for us some of the key moments of what he calls the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights.
In undergraduate, I was a political science major, and then I went to law school, which in the United States is a graduate program, and I took a course on voting rights, and it really opened up my eyes to how my political science background and my legal training could come together. The reason I think it's so important and why I decided to study it is because everything starts with the voter. I mean, you know, if you think about all of the various laws, all of the various rules that govern society, in a democracy at least, the people who decide those laws are elected, right, by the people at large. So nothing starts until you get a voter and then a group of voters to come together to elect someone to a governing body. And then that governing body can pass the laws to regulate society. And those laws are not legitimate unless you have a free and fair election to elect the peoples to that governing body. Yeah. So I think, you know, I sort of came to an understanding that the way the world works, the way society is governed, at least in a free and fair democracy, starts with the voter.
Sure. And you've published already about that, and you're publishing a new book about that. And I had the chance, because you made a presentation last time, to circulate the first draft of the book, no? So I remember I see that the, I don't know how it's called in English, but you know, to who you dedicated, I don't know.
Was the dedication.
Was it one of your family, no?
Yeah, to my kids, to each of my kids.
And you were saying that you hope that they will see how much you contributed, I mean, that you fight for democracy, let's say, and that you were hoping that they do the same, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really important to engage young people in democracy. You know, I always encourage people to bring their kids along with them when they go vote. We always go vote as a family. And we talk about issues of democracy, you know, at the dinner table, essentially, because I think it does start with young people. You know, one of the things that's really discouraging is that voter turnout among young people is low. It increases as you get older.
Yeah.
And I think one way to really reform at least American democracy and probably democracies all around the world is to better engage young people. So I dedicated the book to them. They're 12 and 8 right now, so they're not quite at voting age, but it won't be too long. And I hope they and their generation are engaged citizens.
For you, it's crystal clear that it's so important, democracy, etc. And I mean, your wish now is to have people more committed to that. And so for many people, it's not that clear. And how do you explain that some people are more reluctant or less interested into that and don't feel the same passion as you have for defending democratic rights?
Well, I think, you know, part of the problem is that people sometimes are suffering from their own issues, you know, whether it's poverty, whether it's the daily life and the struggles of daily life, and they don't see how democracy can help their everyday lives. And so I think we as academics and just people in general need to do a better job of explaining to those individuals why democracy actually matters and can help them. You know, it can come down to the smallest thing, like you have a pothole on your street, right? That it's, you know, harder to, or public transportation is not as reliable. Mm. Well, what can you do about that? You can get leaders who will respond to the people. You know, in a true representative democracy where you can vote the bums out if you don't like what they're doing, politicians at least should be responsive to the people because they're fearful that in the next election they won't win. And so I think what we need to do is explain to people who are disillusioned with democracy how it actually impacts their everyday lives.
Yeah. I'm wondering something about, it's a reflection that I have for quite a long time. So you're suggesting that we should explain to people and make them show why it's valuable, and I totally understand, I agree as well. I'm wondering about the means to do that because, you know, if we look at the statistic, and you've said it just before, younger generation, they are even less interested, they go less to vote, and maybe they are less into democracy than older generation. There are some statistics about that. So I'm wondering also if the fact to actually explain them, like what is good for them, actually there could also be some, you know, teenage reaction where I don't like to be told what I should do, you know, or I don't like, okay, you tell me what's good, but you're not my parents, I'm free, I prefer to have maybe something else than voting, something else than democracy. Like, people don't like to be told what to do, even adults. I mean, it's not only teenage, mm-hmm. I say teenage, but so do you think that's part of the problem, or what do you think about that?
So one thing we really need to fix and improve is civics education in schools, right? So one thing we have in all modern democracies is kids are going to school. And so we have a captive audience. And it's more than just telling them democracy is good. You actually have to show it, and you actually have to help them recognize the power. And so I'll tell you a quick story. The students were to look at a problem that they faced in their everyday lives and figure out if they could try to solve it. And one problem that the students themselves recognized was that a lot of kids were late to school. Tardiness was a big problem. And when they dived down to figure out why, they realized that a lot of the students didn't have reliable transportation. These were high school students. The kids went to the city council and convinced them to pass a law, and the program is known as Kids Ride Free. And then the next school year, tardiness went down. Kids were not showing up late as much because they can now get to the school with free public transportation. Mm. I don't think any of those students will ever forget the power of local democracy to change their lives, to change the reality of their everyday problems. And so that's the sort of thing we need to do. In the scholarship world of education policy, it's known as action civics. Teaching students not just by telling them to memorize different aspects of how government works, or, you know, in America, we often say, well, students need to be able to recite the Declaration of Independence. That's boring. That's memorization. That doesn't instill in them the value of democratic engagement. But an action civics project like they did in Washington, D.C. certainly would.
So here also the difference that I see from before what I was saying, like people don't like to be told what to do. Here, not only you're saying it's not about the message telling them, oh, go to vote, it's do it for democracy, but actually making them live that and experience that by themselves so that they really feel that in their bones.
Exactly, exactly right. Another reform that I'm excited about is lowering the voting age to 16, at least mm-hmm. for local elections. Studies show that 18 is not a great age to start the habit of voting. At least in America, kids are moving out of their home, they're either going to university or they're entering the workforce. We move a lot in America, and so people are often moving far away from home. Now we have various voting laws that make you register to vote, obtain the right kind of ID. There's so much going on in an 18-year-old's life, it's no wonder that voting is not a priority. Mm. But if we lower the voting age to 16, maybe just for local elections or school board elections, we have them all there still in school. We can get them registered. We can educate them properly. And what's happened, there's about 6 cities in the United States, mostly in Maryland and California, that have done this, that have lowered the voting age to 16 for local elections or school board elections. Mm-hmm. And what the studies show is that voter turnout jumps about double for 16 and 17-year-olds as compared to 18 to 24-year-olds. So it seems to make a big difference. And then the idea is that if you start voting in the first election when you're eligible, you're much more likely to become a habitual voter. Mm. And studies also show that if you miss the first election when you are an eligible voter, you're much more likely to become a habitual non-voter. And so I think one key is to figure out, how do we get young people to start engaging earlier on so that they become lifelong voters. Scotland is a great example of this, where it lowered the voting age for the independence referendum. Both sides, both major political parties, saw it as a success, and then they lowered the voting age for all elections in Scotland. And I think the results have been pretty positive in terms of engagement of young people.
So if the question is also about creating a habit, so there's of course this age limit that we can lower, but also would you be in favor of making vote compulsory?
I think so, yeah. Some countries have done that. Australia is the example that most people point to.
Belgium, because we're in Europe.
Belgium, certainly, yeah. other places like, I think Argentina has compulsory voting. 16 and 17 year olds are allowed to vote in Argentina, but it's not compulsory, but once 18, I believe, it's compulsory there. I was actually part of a working group in America through the Brookings Institution that looked at compulsory voting. We called it universal voting. I think it sounds a little bit nicer, universal civic duty voting. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that, yeah, I think that would solve a lot of the problems. I mean, one of the things it would do was kind of take away what sometimes is referred to as the voting wars in America, where the parties are fighting over who's allowed to vote, and we're passing all of these voting rules that lead to voter suppression, especially when it comes to minority individuals. We obviously have a very sorry history of racism in America, and it exists still to this day with respect to a lot of voting policies. Universal voting, I think, would fix a lot of that. Now, I'm not so naive as to think that it's likely to pass in America nationwide, but I think the countries that have it see a lot of positivity with respect to voter turnout and voter engagement. And in fact, the electorates in those countries often are much better educated on civic issues than in other countries.
Yeah, that would be interesting to have a statistic. I don't know if you have them or whatever, but maybe not, of course, about the turnout, but that wouldn't say much, but about how people support democracy, like what is the attitude of people for democracy? So Belgium, Australia, compared to countries where it's not compulsory, does the fact to make it compulsory make people actually like more democracy?
Well, one thing you can look at with respect to that is how many people submit a blank ballot, or in the countries that allow it, have a none of the above option, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not requiring you to vote for a specific candidate, but requiring you to submit a ballot, either blank or choosing none of the candidates. And yet what you see in these countries is that it's a pretty small percentage of people who do that. And so that suggests, at least to me, it doesn't prove it, but it suggests that people are engaged enough to choose a candidate. We do know that some studies show that, again, voter education is better in those countries than in, say, the United States. But to me, the fact that there are not a large number of ballots that are voting for no candidate suggests that people are engaged and committed, at least, to vote for a particular candidate. Now, there's a lot of other voting reforms we could talk about. Ranked choice voting, I think, has a lot of promises as well. Again, yeah, and again, to help engage people and give them better choices and actually be able to show their preferences.
I'm actually doing my PhD thesis on similar topics, so we'll talk about it just after. You said, I'm not so naive to think that in the US such laws could pass. And why do you think so? Is it all politics because people don't have an advantage to have everyone allowed to vote?
I think it's more than just politics. I think Americans have a real sense of individuality and freedom from government dictates. When Barack Obama was president and helped pass the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, for healthcare coverage, there's a lot of resistance to people just getting healthcare coverage, even though the government was going to provide it. There's this whole notion of the talking line was, the government can't make me eat broccoli, can't make me be healthier. Mm. So there's just a streak of individuality. I do think the way to go about it in America would be to see if we could get a city to pass it in a state that would allow a city to enact its own voting rules. If a city were to pass it for its elections, we would have at least some good data about how it works, what the problems are, and hopefully a success story. That's exactly what happened with ranked choice voting in America. Mm-hmm. It started in San Francisco in 2002, spread to some other cities, Portland, Oregon, Portland, Maine, some places in Minnesota, St. Paul and Minneapolis, Minnesota. And now it's being used statewide in the state of Maine, in Alaska, and Nevada voters will vote this November as to whether to adopt it. And the Nevada Constitution is a little weird in that the voters have to pass something two elections in a row for it to take hold, and the voters passed it once already 2 years ago, and so they're going to get the measure again. So we're seeing this local reform for ranked choice voting spread to other cities, but now other states as well.
So maybe because maybe not everyone is familiar with that. I think it's in Europe, maybe in Ireland it was used, but can you explain briefly what's ranked voting?
Yeah, so instead of having to vote for just one candidate on the ballot, you get to rank order your preferences. I like this person first, this person second, this person third, and so on. And then the counting, the way the counting works is essentially we look at which candidate received the fewest first place votes. That candidate is eliminated and the ballots are redistributed so that the second choice on that ballot counts. And you basically keep doing that until you have a candidate that has 50% of the vote. So instead of a situation where a candidate wins with maybe 30 or 40% of the total vote, even though they had the most votes, now you have a much more of a consensus candidate.
You have much more of a consensus. And also, I mean, one big advantage that I see in that, at least for example, with the French system that I'm more familiar with, that it eliminates what we call the vote utile, like useful vote. So for example, you are really into a candidate, but that will do just 5% of the vote. Then there are someone who's doing, who has a chance to be elected, an actual chance to be elected as president. And for example, people don't like Macron, but don't like even less Le Pen or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And they like a very more leftist candidate, just for instance. And with that, they can put their favorite candidate first, and yeah. then second, they can put Macron, or, and then the Le Pen if they like, unless, yeah. or vice versa if they...
Yeah. In America, we call that the spoiler effect, or the spoiler vote. If you're voting for the lesser of two evils, you have to choose that, or you vote for the third party candidate, which can spoil the results, essentially. And there are examples where this made a difference. So in the 2000 presidential election in America, between George W. Bush and Al Gore, of course, that election came down to Florida, and 537 votes out of millions cast in Florida changed the result or dictated the result of George W. Bush winning the state and therefore the presidency. But there were thousands of people who voted for Ralph Nader, a Green Party candidate, a third party candidate who had no chance of winning in the Electoral College. If just some of those voters had selected Al Gore instead, Gore would have won Florida and the presidency. Now, if we had had a system of ranked choice voting, it's probably likely that the Nader voters would have put Ralph Nader 1 and Al Gore 2, because Gore was a much more palatable choice for those voters than George W. Bush. So I do think that something like ranked choice voting would have actually changed at least that election, potentially others. You know, the election between Trump and Hillary Clinton came down to just a handful of states and not a lot of votes in those states. Same with Trump versus Biden in 2020.
Yeah, and in the longer term, so it would not only help for that specific election, but since the wish that you have is to have people more committed, I also believe that if people can see that their vote is better reflected in the result, maybe they will be much more into participating in the democratic.
I think that's right. And again, the cities that have adopted it in the US, we do see better voter engagement. So I think that's right. And you know, people say, well, it seems more complicated, but everyone has preferences, right? So, you know, we're in Italy right now. I love gelato. And so I like using the example of if I go into the local gelato shop and they don't have my favorite flavor, I don't just leave without any gelato, right? I get my second choice. Mm-hmm. We all have preferences. And
yeah,
so
right.
Shouldn't we be able to express those preferences at the ballot box?
That makes very sense. Then back to the statistic where I was saying that more and more people are not so into democracy. How do you explain that? Because so first that could be education, of course, like we could do better, like you say, also make them feel them the value, etc. But these are ways to do it. How do you explain that we need, I have the impression, or maybe you'll tell me the opposite, but I have the impression we need more and more to provide even more efforts to convince people that democracy is a good thing. So why do you think people start to be not disgusted, but like going far away from democracy?
Well, you know, this is not a recent phenomenon, right? You know, we've seen this happen in, in Germany in the 1940s, right? Where, Hitler was, became a leader under a populist idea.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about the history of Italy, but, you know, Mussolini, I suspect, was kind of came about from a similar ideal of populism, telling the people what they want to hear, what they think they want to hear, which is really more about consolidating power. Unfortunately, I think Trump is leading down some of those same paths right now in America, telling, you know, particularly poorer people, only I can fix it, only I can help. And they believe it. And so I have to just circle back to education. I think that if we were to truly educate people, now there's a lot of other problems, of course, with the media landscape, with social media, and you know, AI now is changing things. So there's not one cause here, and there's not one solution. But I do think if we could double down on our commitment to education, then these populist ideals perhaps would not create or would not have as much sway among so many people.
So for you, the...
Let me add one more thing real quick, by the way. That's not to say that only uneducated people are drawn to these ideas of anti-democracy. There are certainly very many smart people as well. And I think that goes a lot to political power, right? So people see the desire for political power, and sometimes that's through anti-democratic forces. And so we also need to think about what it means to have power in society, and, you know, why there's a benefit to what we call in America checks and balances, mm-hmm. right? Or this diffusion of power, not in one individual.
So according to you, I mean, what's mainly driving people away from democracy is that they have some needs which are not fulfilled, or I bet so, otherwise they would feel satisfied. And there is one candidate which appeals to what they want to hear, maybe some more populist ideas. And this is what makes people turn away from democracy.
I think that's right. I mean, again, I think there's multiple causes. I don't think we can point to one thing. But that summary, I think, is certainly one cause of the turn towards anti-democracy that we're seeing in many places right now.
Because one explanation that I have in my mind is that people are actually turning away from democracy. But it's very compatible with what you just said. Actually, it aligns very much. Is that maybe it's because they didn't experience the harm of not having democracy. Mm-hmm. You know? Because now we are a generation that we got spoiled. I mean, we grew up with democracy. We are good with that, etc. And maybe, you know, it's just like cigarettes. If you've never tried it, you see it's a bit attractive, etc. You want to try something else, and then you're trying because you don't know what's the harm of a cigarette. I mean, I don't know if you're a smoker or something, but once you get a smoker, every smoker would say that it produces many bad effects for them, like they don't feel good, maybe they feel the need now to have a cigarette. And maybe with democracy, that's also something similar, where if you don't know why it's harming you, then you just want to try something new.
Yeah, I think that maybe is right. And the harms aren't immediate, right? So if you start sliding towards anti-democracy, you may not recognize the harms right away, but slowly they build upon each other. And then all of a sudden you're in a situation where it's hard to get out of. So maybe the cigarette analogy is a good one. So it's not only that they don't recognize the harms because they haven't experienced it, but that the harms are sometimes hard to understand, or at least hard to grasp, and they take a while to see the actual results.
Yeah, because then after it's about short-term versus long-term effects. So getting back to the cigarette, short-term you get actually a reward. You're mm-hmm. kind of happy to smoke. And maybe that's only in the long-term that you see the effects.
Yeah. And the other thing I'll say, at least about America and the rise of Donald Trump, is that race also plays a part in this, in the American story, right? That a lot of white individuals see a threat to the power that whites have always had in America, especially then with the rise of Barack Obama becoming the first black president. And so Trumpism, it's not entirely explained by this, but I think part of the explanation also is a backlash with respect to race, which again goes back to political power.
Do you think we could expand not only race, but also to more general conservative versus progressive values, I mean, culturally? So, for example, even with religion, abortion, race, etc., where some people lived with a model that they had in mind, and maybe they feel threatened because what they were experiencing, so what they are used to, their comfort is to have, you know, for example, LGBTQ, to have one man, one woman for a couple, to have the traditional life, religious, doing the things well, and maybe all these changes are actually creating a feeling of insecurity and threatening for them, and that's why they are so much against all these changes.
I do think religion plays a large part of this, but these things intertwine. So this is abortion is a great example of the way I think this is playing out in America. Donald Trump used to be a Democrat. He used to be a registered Democrat. He became a Republican basically because he saw that as the path to power. I don't know what his true views on abortion are, but he's certainly saying the things he thinks that the Republican Party establishment wants to hear with respect to, I'm going to appoint justices to the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade and the right to an abortion. And again, a lot of it has to do with religion. And it's somewhat amazing because Donald Trump, I don't think, is religious. I don't get the sense that he is particularly religious at all. And you get yet the kind of far-right religious individuals who are supporting him. Why? A lot of it is, has to do with abortion and getting religion back into society. I think that's played a big part. And again, it shows how Trump has told people what they want to hear to try to get power.
I really didn't know that part of the story. And if that's true, it's a big thing. I mean, I'm not so familiar, so I let whoever wants to just check online. I imagine there is plenty of sources on that.
Yeah, again, I don't know what his actual personal views on abortion are, but I do know that he had been a Democrat a couple decades ago, and was kind of in with the New York City Democratic establishment when he was a businessman.
Okay.
And he saw a path through the Republican Party, and it worked.
Yeah, that would be indeed, like you just said, confirming the idea that maybe then it's more about what people want to hear and not what the real... Okay. And you've mentioned Roe versus Wade, and that reminds me that the book that you're publishing is actually about the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So why do you think the Supreme Court has a role in protecting voting rights?
Well, so when people talk about, you know, what happened on January 6, 2021, the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, or just the voting we have in America, often it's, if you look at Congress and you see that, support of Congress is pretty low. The presidency, I mean, whether it's Trump or it's been Biden, support of the incumbent president has been low. But people, I think, generally at least used to think of the Supreme Court as a protector of rights. And what this book aims to do is explain why, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has been pretty bad on voting rights as well. So, the reason it's important is that the court is supposed to be the protector of individual rights against majoritarianism suppression, right? Against the majority trying to change the voting rules or suppress voting rights in an effort to keep themselves in power, which is a lot of what happens. You have these rules that politicians enact with the sole goal, essentially, of making it harder for the other side to win and easier for them to win re-election. The court used to be a protector of the individual voter. In the 1960s, there was a handful of cases in which the court elevated the constitutional right to vote. Hmm. But really, over the past 50 years, we've seen the court backslide on its protection of voting rights. And so the book tells that story for a general audience. So it's written with the everyday voter in mind. It's essentially each chapter is a case study about a significant case in which the court harmed the right to vote. Some of the cases people have heard of, probably, like Bush v. Gore, again, which ended the 2000 presidential election.
You need to reset, because I don't think, yeah, at least for European listeners, that...
But I mean, you may have heard of at least the controversy that involved the 2000 presidential election in Bush v. Gore. Another case that most Americans would know is Citizens United, which is about corporations spending money on campaigns. So I tell the stories of those cases, which again, people who talk about democracy in America at least have heard those names, heard the names of those cases. But I also talk about some other cases from 40 and 50 years ago that laid the foundation for the court's current underprotection of the right to vote.
So you're saying that before, if I understand well, the Supreme Court was better playing the role of protecting voting rights, and it got a bit worse in the latest years.
That's right. Now, before the 1960s, the court was pretty bad. So okay, it was really the 1960s was the high mark of the court protecting voting rights. Previous to that, there were a bunch of cases in which the court did not protect the voting rights. A good example is a case called Minor versus Happersett, which was about women's suffrage. Before the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that enfranchised women, this case held that the Constitution did not protect the rights of women to vote. So the court was, I think, pretty bad until about the 1960s. And then we had the court do what I think it should be doing all along, which is actually protect voters in a series of cases. And then we started the backsliding again. But what's interesting about the past 40 or 50 years is that the court has not been explicit in what it's doing. It chips a little way here, a little way there, and now you look back 50 years later and you say, oh, now we can see this is what's happened. But the court, you know, was at this high water mark in the 1960s, and then slowly and incrementally started to get worse. And now we see the problems that it's created.
Okay, so we can see that when we see the bigger picture. But do you think at that time it was intentional from them, or themselves, they were not realizing what's happening?
So some of the cases, I think, were not intentional. I mean, so one of the cases I talk about was written by Justice John Paul Stevens, who is known as a liberal justice, who in later years would, I think, lament some of the decisions, perhaps, as not protecting voting rights enough. And so I think when he wrote that case, in the case I'm thinking of in particular is the first case I discuss in the book, Anderson versus Celebrezze, which revolved around a third party running for president in 1980, again talking about third parties earlier. And in that case, Justice Stevens wrote a decision which later justices then used, and I think maybe distorted somewhat, to even further pull back on voting rights. So I don't think the court was initially trying to underprotect the right to vote under the Constitution, but the cases that it set out earlier on in the 1970s and the 1980s have now been mangled to a point where today the protection is less than it should be.
And so what are your suggestions to stop that and to get back to a more healthy Supreme Court, let's say?
Well, in terms of reforming the Supreme Court itself, I do think there are several things we can do, and I talk about these at the end of the book. There's been a lot of people, particularly Democrats, who have argued for packing the court, that is, expanding the size of the Supreme Court from 9 to maybe 15. I think that's a bad idea, actually. Now, Congress could do it. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that sets out the number of justices. For a long time, early in America's history, there were 6 justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's been 9 since the mid-1800s, but Congress could pass a law to change that. So, although the Democrats, if they controlled Congress and the presidency, could do that, I don't think it's a good idea. And the reason is, what happens when Republicans take over? And then they would pass a new law to increase the court to 21, and then Democrats come back and say, okay, we got to go up to 27, and it just goes back and forth. So I think we need to look at other structural reforms to the court. One idea is term limits. Right now, Supreme Court justices serve for life. I think if we adopted 18-year term limits, that would have a natural rotation where every presidential term gets 2 presidential nominations to the court, basically 1 every 2 years. I think that would be a lot healthier than the situation where you have justices serving for 20, 30 years. Another reform is, I think perhaps over time, we could increase the size of the court, but then have them sit in panels. So the U.S. Courts of Appeals, the kind of mid-level review court before a case might make it to the U.S. Supreme Court, does this. So they have, there's 11 numbered circuit courts of appeals, 1 through 11, and also the D.C. circuit, which hears cases out of Washington, D.C. But those courts are multi-membered, say, you know, the Fifth Circuit, which covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, has 17 judges on it, but they sit in 3 judge panels to hear cases, a random draw of 3 judges. Why don't we do that for the U.S. Supreme Court as well? Another idea would be to let some of those court of appeals judges sit occasionally on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's called sitting by designation. Have a more regular rotation of people who hear these cases. Why that I think that would work is because it would take away the focus on the identity of the justices and make the decisions more about the law, not who's on the court. Right now, we have a 6-3 conservative majority. In any high-profile case, whether it's about abortion or same-sex marriage or gun rights, for example, maybe not same-sex marriage, because I think that has really been accepted now much more in a mainstream American society. But, you know, abortion rights, for example, a hot-button issue, we can pretty much predict how the court's going to come down. It's most likely going to be 6-3 on ideological lines. If we had a regular rotation or a court sitting in panels, the decisions would be much less predictable, and you would have, I think, a focus more on the law than on the identity of the justices.
Indeed, at the end, all these ideas are to just depoliticize, make it less politicized, less about politics and all personal opinions, and more about looking at the law, the Constitution.
That's right. And there's no way to get politics entirely out of the court. I don't think anyone suggests that you could remove politics, but I think you're right that depoliticizing the court would go a long way. And again, you know, my area is voting rights. Most voting rights decisions these days are 6-3 or maybe 5-4. We kind of know how they're going to come out. And those are the very cases where the court should not be political, right? The cases about political power is where the court really needs to be as unpolitical as possible, apolitical as possible. Mm. And yet we don't see that right now. But
implicitly, from what you say, I understand that the forces that are threatening or the right to vote are conservative, so the right part of the politics in the US, right?
Generally, yes. Okay. I mean, the Democrats do it a little bit too. Like, for example, when we talk about partisan gerrymandering, the practice of drawing lines when we create a district map, the Republicans, where they control, draw lines to help themselves stay in power. The Democrats, where they control, draw lines to help them stay in power. So the Democrats aren't absolved from some efforts to skew democracy, but right now it's the Republicans that are doing it a lot
especially
when it comes to voting rights in terms of voter eligibility, who can vote. Again, a lot of this has to do with race in America, and you know, right now race and party are very closely aligned, generally speaking, although there's been some shifts in that, but traditionally over the past several election cycles, Black individuals have voted for Democrats. There's been some differences with respect to Hispanic and Latino individuals. But race and party in many places, like in the South, are closely aligned. And so you see the Republican Party trying to make, you know, contract the electorate, basically.
And you were telling us last time about the Distakos tricorn. That was very funny, no?
Yeah. So that's from my first book, the book Vote for Us, on the chapter on voter registration, where I talk about ways that some places are trying to expand the ability to register voters, even in the face of often the conservative side trying to make it harder to register. And the taco trucks example was from Houston, where in a Hispanic neighborhood, taco trucks became voter registration hubs. They had voter registration papers. So when someone bought a taco, they were also asked, are you registered to vote? And the best part of the story, even though I love tacos, I had last night, by the way, I had an Italian taco. It's a piadina, which my daughter actually did a research project on tacos around the world. And she learned that the Italian version is the piadina, and I happened upon a place last night, so I got to try it.
That's
it. But
there was no reform for you to register on the Italian.
Not when I got my piadina. But one of the best parts of that story is that the voter turnout in those neighborhoods went up after the taco trucks became voter registration sites. And so I think we see a real world example of ways to improve voter turnout, even in the face of some attempts to push back against voting rights.
Okay. Thank you in general. That was super interesting. I'm very happy I did this episode with you. And I say ciao to everybody and see you for the next episode. Ciao. Thank you again.
Thank you.